Welcome to She's History. I'm your host, Laura Borsma. It's Women's History Month and award season, so let's talk about women in Hollywood. In this episode, author, film critic, and journalist Helen O'Hara tells us about her new book, Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film. We talk about women in leadership roles when filmmaking was first invented, but were then later written out of Hollywood history. We talk about Alice Guy Blanchet, who is the first female film director. She made one of the first, if not the first, narrative films. We talk about Lois Weber, one of the first female American filmmakers. We talk about how Mary Pickford became a Hollywood studio owner with United Artists. We talk about female action stars in the 1910s like Pearl White. Helen also tells us about Nell Shipman, who was a filmmaker in the 1910s making adventure films in nature. She worked in extreme conditions that make Iñárritu and his film The Revenant look comfortable. Helen's book is available now digitally. The printed edition will be out in the U.S. in November, or you can have it shipped from the U.K. right now if you just can't wait. Let's dive in. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'm honestly super excited about your book because I'm a filmmaker and I love Hollywood history, and all of our filmmaker friends, we all get together and we kind of chat about some of these stories. But
amazing.
You found really fun stories that I've never heard of. Mm-hmm. And so what inspired you to write this book?
Well, it's stuff that I've been kind of talking about and writing about in bits and pieces, you know, just in my day job as a journalist. So, you know, I write for Empire Magazine most of the time, and we talk about some of these issues just in the office, on the podcast, in the magazine. And that's with the more kind of modern stuff that's in the book. But in terms of the historical stuff, that's come up in places, in stuff that I've written for other people. And I used to write for a sort of feministy online magazine called The Pool, which sadly no longer exists. Aww. But they gave me loads of room to just kind of talk to women about this stuff and think about this stuff. So yeah, so it just kind of came down to, I got the chance to go into publishers for a meeting, and I said, look, this is kind of what I'd like to do. I'd like to sort of try and bring all this stuff together and try to tell some kind of, you know, it's wildly ambitious, a vague overview of like 120 years of Hollywood history for women, because
yeah,
there have been women there since the dawn of the silent era, and their stories don't get told in the same way that the men's do. And we're told that this is a kind of a great medium that was invented by men and shaped by men and is still telling men's stories and is still mostly directed by men. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's not the full story. And I feel like if we don't know that, then it's harder to make our case nowadays that, you know, something needs to change.
In your book, you mentioned how a lot of women were written out, like literally written out of history. So was it hard to find these stories, or was your process of research difficult?
I did a lot of research, but I have to say I'm very much standing on the shoulders of giants there, because there are now a lot of academics and just, you know, researchers who are doing this work. So there's a fantastic archive called the Women Film Pioneers Project at Columbia University. And they, you can go online, it's all kind of free to access. And they have assembled just all of these accounts of women who worked on films in the very earliest days. In every role you can possibly imagine, they have women who were doing everything, you know, studio heads, directors, producers, writers, directors, everything. And it's just really fascinating. There are so many stories out there. And all of these are fragments.
And
yeah, and it is really being kind of, you know, literally kind of pieced back together from bits and pieces all over the world. You know, they're going through archives. Jane Gaines, who's the doctor in charge of this, was talking about literally families will be going through their attics and they will find stuff that belonged to great, great grandmother, whoever, and bring it in and say, does this mean anything to anyone? And it's like, oh yeah, it really does.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I want to call her Alice because that's the way her name is mm-hmm. spelled. But I think in the documentary where Jodie Foster is narrating, she calls her Alice. Mm. So Alice Guy Blanchet.
Guy Blanchet, yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us a
little? Fascinating.
Oh my gosh, it's fascinating. It's, yeah, talk about history overlooking her.
Seriously. So she was a secretary to Léon Gaumont, who was one of the first kind of pioneers in filmmaking. He was literally friends with the Lumière brothers, the very first people to project film onto a screen. And he was also involved in like all these making these cameras and making this equipment. And Alice Guy was his secretary, and she was about 22 years old. And she went to that first screening and saw this stuff happening and asked to borrow one of the cameras and made what is arguably, and of course men argue about it, but it's one of the very first, if not the first, narrative film ever. Because those films that the Lumiere brothers and Gaumont were doing, they were documentaries, essentially. It was literally shots of people leaving a factory or a train pulling into a station, famously. And Alice went off and she was involved in amateur dramatics, and she made a little story about a fairy finding a baby in a cabbage patch. And it's, I mean, it's literally 30 seconds long. It's from 1896, but it is one of the very first narrative films anywhere in the world. And she then became, she did more of these, and she became Gaumont's head of production. And her job was kind of like John Lasseter in the early days at Pixar. So she was there to show off what the technology could do. You know, all those old early Pixar shorts, that was basically what he was doing. It was to show off the fact that they could computer animate curves and textures and stuff like this. And she was kind of doing that, you know, just 100 or so years beforehand. So she spent about roughly 10 years at Gaumont and made some estimates 1,000 films. And she was working with color and she was working with sound in the like 1900s. She got married to Herbert Blachet, moved to the US, set up her own studio.
Oh my gosh.
Directed, wrote, produced, you name it. She was doing it there. And was making
amazing.
Like, I know. And by the standards of the time, like big films. She was doing it. She did A Life of Christ. She did A Hunchback of Notre Dame. You know, she did big movies and literally was written out of the Gaumont official history when that came to be written.
Why?
So, because it didn't, I think, now, this is my theory. I'm not saying that Jane Gaines or the other academics who work on this stuff would necessarily accept it as being this simple. But my take on it essentially is that as more and more money came into film, and as film became more and more kind of professionalized and more of a big business, it became something that men didn't want to have women doing anymore. It became sort of an embarrassment to have women doing it. I think they felt it made them look amateurish if they had female directors and female writers and women in serious roles. Because this was a time when women couldn't even vote for the most part, you know?
Yeah.
So when it was essentially a cottage industry, I think it was okay. And then suddenly they were a bit like, ooh, not sure about this anymore.
Ugh, that's so shitty.
I know.
It's just like, oh, man, she's the one who, oh, man, that sucks. God, I have so many questions for you. I love how you just talk about if films were more egalitarian, our world would be too, why stories and representation matter. And, I am curious though about people like the first female, like Alice, I wonder how people addressed her. Like, did they just address her by her first name? Did they say Madam or Miss or Mrs.?
I think it would have been Madame Guy Blachet, I guess. Because she was quite well respected. I mean, there's articles by her in sort of trade magazines of the time, you know, where she was arguing that women, you know, could direct and should direct.
Yeah.
And Lois Weber, who came after her, kind of very much kind of managed her own image and portrayed herself as a very respectable married lady. And that was part of her sort of almost selling point. So there was this very Victorian idea that women were morally superior, inherently morally superior to men, right? So it's our job to keep the men in line because they can't be trusted, but we're somehow pure and virtuous and can be trusted, right? And it's an incredibly patronizing idea, but it worked to some extent in women's favor for a short time, because this kind of growing cinema was able to say, look, we have women involved, so you can trust us. This basically, it was a way of saying, this isn't porn, okay? This is safe and this is respectable, right?
Yeah.
And Lois Weber really, I mean, Alice Guy Blachet leaned into that a little bit. Lois Weber really leaned into it and really was talking about sort of the job of a director being kind of morally uplifting and talking about, she really made issue films and she talked about big kind of questions of the day. She did one about birth control. I mean, it was terrible and the ideas in it are awful, but she was, by the standards of the day, this was her dealing and, you know, delving into the big issues.
Very progressive.
Yeah.
Talk about birth control at the time when women weren't even allowed to vote.
So exactly. Yeah.
And Lois Weber. So she's the first female American director, and she was
one of them.
But she was also on sets, because wasn't she acting in Alice Guy's movies too?
She acted in at least one of Alice Guy's movies, or Alice Guy Blachet as she then was, at Solax, which was the studio that Alice set up in New Jersey. And then the interesting thing about both these women is both of them were able to succeed in their career when they were married. right? Because that almost made them like respectable. And their husbands, to a degree, were their front men, you know, because other men could come to the studio and just talk to the husbands and didn't have to
feel comfortable. It's like, oh, okay,
exactly.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's infuriating, but yes.
And so I genuinely think, again, especially with those two women, part of their problem in later years, as we get into the late 1910s, early 1920s, both of them got divorced. So that kind of illusion that men who came to see them were talking to another man kind of fell apart.
Oh no!
And I think that's another thing that, you know, women couldn't succeed on their own. Would they have succeeded without a husband there? And I'm not saying that the husbands played a creative role, to be clear, because history suggests otherwise in both cases. But the men were there almost as a kind of sop to other men, and it became much more difficult for them to work on their own.
Oh man, that's because as Alice, her husband was also a director, and then he went to Hollywood without her, right?
Yeah.
And then did he take credit for any of her work as a director, or did he do his own thing?
Not that I'm aware of. I didn't see any evidence of that. He was doing his own thing. He'd started off as a cameraman and sort of built up his own thing. And then, yes, went off to Hollywood without her. And I think that's probably just a bit of a, there may have been a bit of professional jealousy. There may have been, you know, tension in the marriage. It's not 100% clear. Mm. But definitely he left her and really didn't come back. And then she also got hit with the Spanish flu in 1919. And so her health suffered. And so, and by that point, you know, the studio had kind of faltered a little bit. So she moved back to France and spent the whole, you know, the next probably 20 years trying to get back into film and being essentially rebuffed. Because by that point, you know, the story was written and it was all about the men and nobody wanted to know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad now her story is being told and other people, and that you're writing books about this, which is great. Okay. So we have Alice and Lois. Tell us about some of the other early female filmmakers that you thought were really fun. And this is still the silent era. This is before talking.
Yeah, because honestly, I mean, most of them were gone, with a couple of exceptions that I'll mention, but most of them were gone by the early 1920s. You know, there were a few, there were scattering who worked through the 20s, but even Lois Weber by that point was finding it really, really hard to get films made. So, but you did have other women there. There was, I think it was Ida Mae Park was one, Cleo Madison was one. And these were sometimes stars who turned director. They were sometimes stars who turned producer and took control of their own kind of destiny that way. Obviously, Mary Pickford, very, very famous that way. Mary Pickford, one of the founders of United Artists, the biggest star of her day. And a lot of her biggest films were written by a woman, Frances Marion, was the first person to win two screenwriting Oscars. She won back-to-back screenwriting Oscars.
I'd rather see that than Mank.
I know. Well, here's the thing. One of the people I interviewed for the book was Mimi Leder, and she actually pitched a film about Frances Marion years ago and found absolutely no interest whatsoever.
Oh, man. So,
yeah.
Oh, that's a bummer. Well, maybe that'll change now.
I hope so.
More female filmmaker or just more stories are being told.
Yeah.
So let's go back. Mary Pickford. So she started United. How did she get to be a studio owner back then? Because that's like a big deal now. Today.
Really big deal. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of the, I guess, DreamWorks SKG of its day. She started off as an actress and she just became extremely popular, extremely fast. She wasn't the first movie star, Frances Lawrence and Frances, oh, I've forgotten the other one. Florence Lawrence and Florence Turner had already preceded her, but she basically became the big movie star of the sort of early 1910s. And so she very quickly climbed in terms of salary and money. She married, at least initially successfully, she married Douglas Fairbanks, who was also a mega star. And so the two of them just had all of this money coming in and they were essentially able to invest in themselves, able to invest in United Artists. But like by the sort of early to mid 1910s, she had control of her director. She got to pick her scripts. She got to pick her co-star. You know, she had the kind of sway that we would now call a producer. You know, like it would be a producer's role now. It wasn't called that then.
Right.
She was a major, major deal.
Oh, that's awesome. So she started it with, it's Charlie Chaplin. Who else was it?
It was Charlie Chaplin, Fairbanks, of course, D.W. Griffith. I've forgotten the fifth one. So well done me.
That's okay. Oh, at the time, D.W. Griffith, Birth of a Nation, did they all know it was racist at the time? Or were they just kind of like, I guess he's making something big? Or did they know, like, this is not good what he's doing?
No, this is something that I hadn't realized. And maybe this is me coming to it as a, you know, Northern Irish person and not being terribly au fait with my US history. But like, I didn't realize how far back the NAACP had existed and had protested this kind of thing. And there were absolutely widespread protests against Birth of a Nation at the time. I mean, there was a black filmmaker around the same time in the 1920s called Oscar Michaud, who was very successful.
Yeah.
And he was occasionally, you know, the authorities would occasionally kind of kick off at him, and they would occasionally try and censor his films and so on the basis that, you know, if he dealt with race issues, that was somehow promoting race riots or something. And he said, look, there is only one film that has promoted race rioting, and that is Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
You know, so everyone knew at the time, but they just, well, I say everyone knew, all the black people knew, certainly. I don't know if the white people paid much attention, but yeah, it was absolutely an issue in its day.
Well, going back to Alice Guy, actually, with the movies, I read somewhere that she had made the first, or one of the first.
One of the first, yeah.
All black cast, like she directed. Like, that's so crazy progressive.
Progressive, yeah. She did, I mean, I'm not saying the contents of the film were progressive, like, to be right. clear, like, as
it's
you'd
not
expect,
perfect. Yeah,
it's really not, but she at least saw that there were people there whose stories should be told. So, you know, not brilliantly told, but she tried.
I know. I think Ava DuVernay, a documentary, I think, kind of talks about it. It's like, well, I guess it was made.
I mean, it would have been a step in the right direction if Hollywood had kind of taken it up, which of course for years they really didn't. So there was a little bit of a kind of parallel black cinema, like independent black cinema, like this Oscar Michaud guy and people like that. But it didn't get the level of like distribution, essentially, that you needed to be challenging the Hollywood studios. That was never allowed to develop.
Yeah.
So yeah, they really kind of stifled that at birth. There was of course Hallelujah in 1929, but that's a King Vidor film. So again, it's a white director who wanted to get it made, and he did fight for an all black cast, and he did try his best. But again, it's a mess, and it's a mess that maybe a black filmmaker would not have caused. You know.
Yeah. Okay. So the early 1900s, when film was just discovered, it was pretty much a Wild West.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people saw, oh, this is an industry. We're going to make some money off of this.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's when women started getting pushed out and the studios started forming. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tell us about, so then there was some women at the beginning, like Lois Weber.
Yeah.
Then it just, they got pushed out. But Mary Pickford was still kind of around, because she was around during talkies, right? Or was she?
Her career was kind of on the wane by then. She was older and she'd always played tomboy characters. So she was one of those people who had trouble kind of maturing with her audience in a way. You know? But yeah, essentially the women were there. I mean, so Universal was a famously female friendly studio. That's where Lois Weber spent the sort of most successful part of her career. They had a number of other female directors around her. There, I think it was Bluebird Films. Sort of sub-label was very female dominated.
Okay.
But then they too became a bit more hostile to women as time went on, or just kind of let them lapse. Just kind of, it was never a mass exodus. It was never a decree. I certainly am not aware, and I wasn't able to find anyone who was aware of any kind of letter that went out going, we're not going to hire women for this anymore.
Yeah.
It just kind of stopped being an option. And I think that is the money men in New York coming in and sort of like kind of looking quizzically when you see a woman directing, because at this point, the other thing is the roles were becoming more fixed, you know? So at the beginning, you're Alice Guy, you have a little bit of money and you can buy your own studio and you can do all the roles and you can set this all up. And Lois Weber actually tried to go back to that in the 1920s and find it essentially economically impossible, because at that point we're talking industrialized production, we're talking about the contract system, we're talking about, you know, this producer-led form of movie making that is only really feasible and financially guaranteed at a studio level.
That's crazy.
So yeah, so sorry, your question was, I think the exceptions, there were a few exceptions. So Dorothy Arzner is the biggest of the exceptions. So she started in the silent era, and managed to survive into the sound era. So she was working into the 30s and 40s, almost alone at a studio level in terms of female directors.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. It seems a weird thing to suggest, but it might have helped that she was a lesbian.
Oh, interesting. But was she out? Because wasn't this right before like the Lavender Scare and McCarthyism and all that stuff?
With... By the standards of the time, she was pretty open about it. By the standards of our time, you know, the closet door was very slightly ajar, you know. But she dressed like a man and she, you know, she wore the kind of tailored suit. She had short hair. You know, she, when you see pictures of her, she carries herself very confidently. There was none of the kind of like, you know, middle-class, middle-aged lady thing that Lois Weber was doing. She was very much more kind of one of the guys. And it's interesting to me that when you see female directors coming later, somebody like Ida Lupino, who started directing in the 50s.
Yeah.
She kind of dressed, you know, dressed down, dressed unglamorous on set. She was obviously an actress turned director, but she kind of de-glammed herself for directing to look like, again, I think a bit more like one of the guys. So I wonder if there's an element of kind of presentation there.
Yeah.
And this is not to say that Hollywood wasn't horrifically homophobic at the time. Like, to be clear, it really was. But I do wonder if just in particularly in Dorothy Arzner's case, just the way she presented herself might have helped in this very kind of macho atmosphere. I don't know.
Well, it makes sense, though, especially when dealing with, because I'm curious how it was dealing with early cast and crew. Like just authority and just getting, because I think you mention it and you talk a little bit about it in the book and stuff where it's like, earlier crew was kind of, they were on board and then it became more and more hostile.
Yeah. So like Alice Guy, when she was still at Gaumont in France, you know, there were crew members who just hated her apparently. And one of them chopped up a completed set that she was ready to shoot on.
Oh my God.
You know, and it was one of those things where you've got plausible deniability. You're like, oh, I thought we'd finished with this one. Oh, I just, you know, I thought we were done. So I, you know, but I mean, it was a big mistake and it was a, you know, it was a big kind of blow. And that kind of little thing just kept happening. And there were attempts to remove her as head of production as it became a bigger job, you know, and she had to go to the board. Gustave Eiffel, as in the Eiffel Tower, was on the board and apparently was the one who saved her job. So that's cool.
That's so cool.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, that's amazing.
But yeah, but like there was hostility there. And several of the other women directors at the time talked about it, that at the beginning of their careers in the sort of 1900s, 1910s, the crews had been kind of cool with it. But as this became more professionalized and as the roles became more kind of codified, then suddenly they're like, well, this is not all us in this for a lark. We're not doing this. We're not all in this together. That person is my boss. And my boss is a woman? Ew. You know, and they just...
Yeah.
I think there was a real disconnect there. I think that's where direct sexism, well, again, comes into play. Let's be honest, there's quite a lot of it in here in the story. But yeah.
Yes. You talk about how there was kind of everything went into gender roles and then women maybe had opportunities when it was more looked at as like a women's picture or it was something where it was relationship-y or like one of those kind of things. Well, and I feel like that's what's happening now. It's so many women are actually the audience too, that it's this recognition of, hey, we should actually make stuff that does connect more to the audience.
Yeah.
Because so far in early cinema, it was just, you had women, but they were just on camera. They're mainly actresses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think there was a real feeling of, and I think it's something you're right, we're still reckoning with now. Like, you know, do women have something in particular to offer as women? And it's really hard to say because you don't want to confine women directors to just making quote unquote women's pictures.
Right.
You know, because and the weird thing is that some of the women directors who have succeeded are the ones who are really good at making stories about men. So like Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah,
is a woman who's incredible at talking about masculinity. Like that's what most of her films are about. And she would be completely wasted on rom-coms, like totally and utterly wasted. Lynn Ramsey, I would argue, is another. I think she's extraordinary. She's actually a very good director of women as well, but she's extraordinary at directing men. And I'm not just saying that women should direct women's films, but I do think that there is something that women can bring to a story in particular that we're not always given credit for. And you see that in something like, and this is the drum I always beat, but you see it in something like Wonder Woman. If you contrast Wonder Woman with, say, Supergirl or Elektra or Catwoman,
yeah,
you can, there's a qualitative difference. Like, you can see that Patty Jenkins is genuinely trying to engage with what women's fantasies are, what women's dream, what a women want to see in a superhero.
Yes.
In a way that, you know, Supergirl, I'm sorry, like, I loved it as a kid because it was all I had, but like, it's not good because it doesn't do that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, she comes to Earth and she goes to a girls' boarding school and she falls in love with the first cute guy she sees. Like, this is not really my fantasy. Like,
yeah.
This is
not,
you know, and
come on. Yeah.
Yeah, really? And I mean, like, Elektra and Catwoman, I mean, they're trying to convince me that Halle Berry is a homely loser who can't get dates. Are you kidding me? You kidding me? Seriously.
Well, and some of those roles too, especially in some of the like Angelina, like Tomb Raider stuff, a lot of them, they've just felt like they were written for men and
yeah.
cast a woman to play.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so.
It's a very masculine.
And I mean, role. Like, that can work. Like, Salt was literally written for Tom Cruise and then Angelina Jolie ended up starring in it. And I actually think it works pretty well.
That's true.
But you do have to kind of bring something to it. I remember seeing, and I'm talking about quite bad films here for some reason, but anyway, I remember seeing Wanted, right, which is another Angelina Jolie role.
Yeah.
And it took me a little while after seeing it to kind of figure out why her role in that film feels so fresh and different and weird. And I finally figured out, at least the way I see it, she plays the cool person in that film. She plays the sort of, I don't know, the Clint Eastwood role. Right. She is the super cool person. She doesn't explain herself. She doesn't really try to, you know, cozy up to anyone. She's just the untouchably cool person standing over there who doesn't have to do anything to be the center of the scene.
Yeah.
Women don't get to play that. Like, that's
true.
Incredibly unusual. It's become a little bit more common recently, a little tiny bit. But I mean, genuinely, I remember being like,
yeah,
why,
Charlize
why does
Theron
this feel
does
weird?
That. I could see
she's good at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
The old guard or something. She's kind of that role as well. Or and a little bit Black Widow is not a million miles off.
Oh yeah, that's true. That's true. But I love in Wonder Woman how it's like she's so strong, she's so tough, she could fight, and then Patty Jenkins will have her like, get excited about ice cream or a baby. I love that. It's like that combo of stuff. Where
exactly.
Let's tell some of the stories of some of these other early women that I'd never heard of. There's God, there's so many.
I didn't even mention some of the silent era women, like the action heroines of the silent era. I thought that was fascinating.
I loved hearing that. Yes. Yeah, let's talk about that because that was really fun talking about the early Tom Cruise's women doing such awesome, like jumping from trains.
Yeah, absolutely. Literally jumping from trains. I just think it's amazing. So there was this kind of vogue for, and sort of we're talking like 1912, 1913, there was this kind of vogue for action serials starring women. So you had The Hazards of Helen, obviously that's my favorite, the Perils of Pauline, The Exploits of Elaine, like, you know, they were really into alliteration. But
amazing.
But these women would literally be jumping off trains or riding horses. There was one where one of them sort of dangles out of a hot air balloon. She's climbing cliffs, you know, fighting wild animals, solving mysteries, saving their husbands or boyfriends or fathers or sons or whatever. You know, they were proper kind of action stories.
That's amazing. And they were actual women doing this, not just like cut and then a stunt man dressed as a woman.
Well, so that's one of them, for example. I think it was Pearl White, who was very successful for a while. She did suffer some injuries, which meant that they did bring in a stunt man to do some of her work after that. So she had done her stunts for the first half of her career. In the second half of her career, there was this guy brought in, and that became known to everyone when he died during one of the stunts. So that was a huge scandal at the time. But yes, they generally did their own stunts. And that was the exception rather than the rule, at least at that point in history.
And then there was also, you talk about...
Oh, it was Nell Shipman?
Nell Shipman, yes. Who did... She was like the early Inaritu doing her own Revenant movie.
Yeah.
But more badass.
Seriously badass. I mean, she was amazing. She was, she basically went off into the middle of the Canadian wilderness to shoot this film and brought everybody with her. And we're talking people literally fighting frostbite and, you know, lung infections and pneumonia, because it was something like 40 degrees below. Oh, and in the heart of the Canadian winter. I mean, it was crazy. And yeah, she kind of led them through that. Well, most of them, sadly. But even, I mean, the director ended up, I think, nearly losing his foot at one point. He had to be transferred down to, I think he ended up in San Francisco. He got transferred to one hospital, then another, kind of going down the coast.
Oh, no.
The whole time that he didn't want to lose his foot and he wouldn't let them amputate. And they were like, I mean, it's not looking good, dude, but okay.
Oh, wow.
And she was like famously good with, you know, she had wild animal pets and she kind of brought them with her. So she kind of had this relationship with these animals that you see on screen. She was incredible, absolutely amazing.
That's amazing. So she was the main actress, or she
was the main actress, the director. No, she produced. She did direct later on that one. She did direct later in her career, but the kind of this kind of fad for these movies was kind of passing by that point, so those weren't as financially successful, sadly.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. But then there were other women that were also part of early Westerns too.
Yeah, there were women. I mean, there were basically women kind of everywhere. They just didn't always get the credit for it, you know? I mean, and Nell Shipman basically got written out of history to the point where when, you know, sort of in the 50s or 60s, she kind of wrote off looking for retirement benefits from the Motion Picture Fund. They were like, we can't find any of your credits. And several people got that back.
Wow, that sucks.
But yeah, there was child actors as well who they just lost their credits and didn't know anything about them. And so sorry, kids. Bye.
Because they didn't have an IMDb or internet where they could
monitor. And these women had been written out of history, and they're, you know, Alice Guy wrote a memoir, wasn't published. Nell Shipman wrote a memoir, wasn't published. At least in their lifetimes, it's come out now. But there was no appetite for it. That nobody thought it was important to talk about.
God, that's crazy. So they were mainly male historians probably then collecting the information and just leaving out women.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even historians at that point. I guess it would have been almost sort of, you know, studio hacks essentially for the most part.
Interesting.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, they didn't. The thing was as well, and this is also part of the conversation, is that when sound came in, there was a really big push to promote sound and obviously encourage theatre owners to spend this money upgrading their theatres to sound. In the same way that like Jim Cameron tried to push everybody to upgrade so they could show Avatar, you know?
Yeah.
So it was this big push to kind of say, basically what you have now is garbage and you need to have this new thing or you're going to look embarrassing. We're all going to be embarrassed for you.
Yeah.
So there was this kind of effort to really denigrate everybody involved in sound, which of course included most female directors who had ever worked at that point. So literally things like Lois Weber's film Shoes was recut and turned into this kind of, and given a really mocking voiceover. And they basically made fun of this quite serious film about deprivation and poverty and forced prostitution and so on. And, you know, like it's horrific. It's really mean. But that's the only reason that the film survived, because nobody thought these films were really worth preserving at that point. There was no Martin Scorsese there to say, hey guys, we need to keep this stuff. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's well over 80% of all silent movies are completely lost to history.
In the next episode, I continue my conversation with Helen. We talk about the business of the movie industry and how the factory aspect of it had an impact on women. Thank you again to Helen O'Hara, and thank you all for listening.